This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com, especially for you. Today's program is about the Aboriginal people of North America, and we're going to reflect on the early period of immigration, colonization, and missionization. As people arrived from Europe and spread out over the North American continent, starting with the East Coast, is spreading to the West. Movies, TV series, history books, popular novels have with great regularity related stories of the supposed crimes of the Catholic Church against native peoples of the New World. There were many negative effects of the arrival of the colonists. There are stories about the demolition of the Mesoamerican cultures such as the Aztecs and the South American Andean civilizations of the Incas by the Spanish conquistadors. We've heard much about the severe oppression of the indigenous peoples and the devastation delivered upon the native tribes across the Americas from various causes, from slavery, from war, from disease, or just displacement. Much of this is historic fact, but in the picture as commonly presented, there's much important historical fact being left out. Immigration, even in its most benign form, can greatly disturb the life of people living in the affected area. In its worst form, it can exterminate a population. The Catholic Church is regularly attacked for supposed crimes against the native peoples of the New World. But we need to set the record straight about that. In truth, the negative effects of European immigration on the Native Americans in North America was a source of great concern to the Catholic Church, and missionaries distinguished themselves for their heroic defense of Indian rights. There's no question that European colonialism wrought vast troubles for the tribes and cultures of the New World. But the Catholic Church, represented by its missionary and religious, working among these people, spoke up for them. They were the ones that changed things for the better. So it is very mistaken to blame the Catholic Church for the actions of the European secular powers, who regularly punished the Jesuits, Franciscans, Augustinians, and countless priests, nuns, and laypeople for speaking out in defense of the suffering natives. John Tracy Ellis, an American historian, wrote about this. He said, "No informed person would endeavor to maintain that the churchmen were always in the right, but by the same token, no one can deny that they were generally on the side of the angels in their treatment of the Indians." Who spoke up for the Indians? Well, for example, it was the outraged voice of the friar Bartolomeo de las Casas, who first made Europe aware of the fate that had befallen thousands of the natives in enslavement by the Spanish conquerors. As it was, the agitation aroused by Estas, Bishop de las Casas returned to Spain, to the court of Ferdinand Isabella, and began a great debate, a famous debate, maintaining that the Indians had souls, spoke up for their rights to humane treatment. All of this prompted Pope Paul III in 1537 to issue the bull Sublimis Deus, in which he declared, "The said Indians and other people who may later be discovered by Christians are by no means to be deprived of their liberty or the possession of their property, even though they be outside the faith of Jesus Christ." I want to point out that the bull Sublimis Deus, being issued in 1537, was issued very soon after the arrival of the first Spaniards in the New World. This period of immigration and colonization was called the Age of Exploration. And the size of the land area and the size of the population of natives was a surprise to Europeans. It slowly dawned on the expedition leaders that the landmass opening before them was far larger than they had anticipated. The explorers of North America had arrived on a continent containing approximately 2 million inhabitants, a rich variety of tribes with established cultures. These tribes were quite varied. Some were very advanced, some were very primitive. Some warred on neighboring tribes, some were relatively peaceful. There were many quite wonderful aspects of these native societies. At the same time, all these peoples exhibited the normal human frailties. The general trend was for the Spanish to colonize the south, and the French to colonize the north. Catholic Spain began to conquer Mexico and the Incan Empire, and Catholic France began colonies in what is now eastern Canada. The Spanish and French governments provided the explorers and settlers with patents and royal permissions that contained specific instructions about bringing Christ to all they met and welcoming such peoples into the Catholic faith. Christopher Columbus, for example, was ardent and steadfast in his belief that there was a higher purpose to his explorations. He thanked God for the spirit and strength to accomplish this feat. Christopher Columbus wrote, "Render thanks to Jesus Christ, who has granted us so great a victory and such prosperity. Let Christ rejoice on earth as he rejoices in heaven, in the prospect of the salvation of the souls of so many nations hitherto lost." I want to point out that Christ's grand commission was to go forth and preach the gospel to all nations in order that their passage into heaven be secured. If we truly care about the well-being of native peoples, why wouldn't we care about their destiny in the next life? Why wouldn't we care a great deal about that, about telling them about Christ, about salvation through Christ? Or don't we really believe it? Don't we really believe in the immense value of it? Why wouldn't we care a great deal about that? And at least give them the opportunity to hear about it. If we missionize native peoples, if we really do care about the real life that lays before each one of them, then we will go to each of them and tell them about Christ and his salvation. We'll do it if we care. In this secularized age, it's hard for us to appreciate the reality of the necessity to save souls, to give these people a chance to know Christ in heaven. Most of the Spanish expeditions were accompanied by devout priests and religious who took such counsel as the Sublimus Deus to heart. The French explorers, on the other hand, were decidedly dedicated to evangelization as they opened trails into the American wilderness. This began a period of Catholic missionary efforts that remains unparalleled in history. The first seeds of evangelization were planted by the Spanish Franciscan Juan de Padilla, who gives us a great example of the zeal that these missionaries had. He entered America at the Rio Grande with the explorer Francisco de Coronado. Father Padilla and two Franciscan companions traveled the expedition as far north as Kansas, where they were welcomed by the Wichita tribe. When Coronado and his men returned to the south, Father Padilla and his companions remained in the area and established a mission. As Father Padilla was journeying toward present-day Harrington, Kansas, to welcome another community to Christ, he was slain by a war party of a neighboring tribe. This was 1542. After that, the Society of Jesus and the Franciscans sent their best-educated and most-trusted priests to the new land. Father Jacques Marquette, a Jesuit, volunteered for the missions in 1666 and served the Algonquins in Canada. The Indians there spoke of his faithfulness and caring ways, and the Illinois Indians invited him to visit them and to see the great waters, the Mississippi River. He and Louis Joliet, we call him, explored the Mississippi and the Great Lakes, opening trails, making possible a series of missions among the Illinois, the Kaskaskians, and other tribes. Father Marquette died on the trail while trying to return to his mission. His Indian companions recorded his calm passing in 1675. They dried his bones and placed them reverently in a birch bark container and returned them with solemnity to the St. Ignatian Mission at Mackinac. In the South, a very unique Jesuit was earning the name of the Padre on Horseback. Father Eusebius Francisco Quino was a nobleman of Tyrol. He was sent to La Paz Bay, 1681. And then to an area of the southwest desert, known to the Spanish as Primeria Alta. 6 years later, he founded the Mission Dolores and traveled night and day on horseback to visit Indian settlements. His lasting monument is Mission San Xavier del Bac, near Tucson, Arizona. But he founded a number of other missions. Father Kino also taught the local tribes how to adopt the innovations of European farmers and shepherds and modernize their irrigation projects. The Indians loved Father Kino. Even the Apaches held him in great esteem. They had learned early on not to trust white men. Father Kino also mapped the area of Baja California and proved that that region was not an island, as previously had been believed, but a peninsula. He died with his head resting on a worn saddle. The year was 1711. He'd been missionizing in North America for 30 years. Father Kino opposed the slavery and compulsory hard labor in the silver mines that the Spaniards forced upon the native people. He was an expert astronomer, mathematician, and cartographer. He drew the first accurate maps of Prima Alta, the Gulf of California, and Baja California. By the time of his death, he established 24 missions. His many expeditions on horseback covered over 50,000 square miles. At the start, his missions had 20 head of cattle. He is acknowledged as Arizona's first rancher because the Indians ended up with a larger herd, 70,000 head. You can get a movie from 1977 about him on DVD, Father Kino, Padre on Horseback. This is Setting the Record Straight. I'll see you on the other side of the break.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
We're back with you on BreadboxMedia.com. Back after the break, this is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. Reflecting with you on a few incredibly great men, the missionaries in the New World. We just talked about Father Kino. Let's turn our attention to Eastern North America. That's the area that used to be known as New France before the British incursions. The missions in New France flourished because of the dedication of incredible priests. And in the process, Indian nations and their leaders made a commitment to the Catholic faith that has made an impact on American life ever since. One such nation, called the Old Ones from the East and respected by other tribes, accepted the Jesuit priest, Father Pierre Biard, on Mount Desert Island in Maine. We know them as the Abenaki, a large and powerful nation, and once committed to the faith, they remained steadfast. When the British banned Catholics from Maine and the other colonies, the Old Ones from the East refused to accept an Anglican Bible or a Protestant minister into their enclaves. Jesuit Father Sebastian Rall, a dedicated missionary and a gifted linguist, served them for decades until the British put a price on his head. The Mohawks ultimately murdered Father Rall during a raid on the mission and gave his Abenaki dictionary and other works to the British, who deposited them at Harvard University. General George Washington asked the Abenaki to aid the American cause during the Revolutionary War, and they agreed to become allies if he provided them with a black robe or priest. Washington sent a request to some of the nearby ships of the French Navy, and a French Navy chaplain was assigned to the Old Ones from the East. The Abenaki never lost their commitment to the Catholic faith. In fact, the first Native American bishop of the United States was Donald E. Pelote, SSS, Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico, from 1900 all the way to 2008. Bishop Pelote is an Abenaki by birth. The explorer Samuel de Champlain befriended the Hurons during his first year in North America, early in the 17th century. Over the next decades, many of the Huron became Catholic. Champlain's decision had unforeseen consequences, however. Greatest of the enemies were the powerful Iroquois. The Iroquois had a confederacy, the so-called Five Nations of the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca. They were joined later by the Tuscarora in northern New York. At first, the Iroquois Confederacy allied with the Dutch. Later, they switched their allegiance to the English. Since the first days of colonization, the British had cultivated the Iroquois Confederacy in the northeast of North America, knowing that the French had long before sided with the Hurons against them. The Iroquois Confederacy had been founded in 1570 by a holy man, Tekanawita, who was aided by the revered Onondaga warrior Hiawatha. And the five tribes were united under the Treaty of Peace and maintained trade and defensive alliances. When they wanted to raise an army, the Iroquois Confederacy could field more than 5,000 warriors. One of the tribes of the Confederacy, the Mohawks, were greatly feared by British colonists and by French colonists. And the tribe martyred the Jesuit priests who came among them, including two missionary saints, Saint René Goupil and the renowned martyr Saint Isaac Jogues. As the French were allied to the Hurons, the Iroquois became their enemies, including enemies of the French missionaries. In 1648, for the next 2 years, the Iroquois waged a staggeringly savage war upon the Huron, during which thousands of the Huron were slaughtered. The remnant of the last Hurons relocated near Quebec City and finally settled at Wendake, an area that was called Hurania. This victory of the Iroquois was significant. It changed the character of Indian warfare for the next 80 years. These wars became wars of annihilation, not of skirmishes. For the next 20 years, the Five Nation Iroquois destroyed three more major Iroquois-speaking tribes and scattered others. There were interruptions in their offenses, but eventually raids by the Iroquois emptied the once densely populated Ohio River Valley, destroying tribes so thoroughly that in many cases even the names of the tribes involved have been lost. In some cases, archaeologists know that Indian towns were inhabited until the 1670s, in part because they have found European trade goods from that time period in the towns. But they cannot associate a tribal name with these towns. The Iroquois eventually raided tribes as far south as South Carolina and far west as Illinois. The victories of the Iroquois Confederacy eventually made English settlement of the interior of North America much easier. They also eliminated key French allies like the Hurons and left large areas that had been densely populated, almost deserted. The Iroquois, a century later, to draw off British pressure on their territories in the province of New York, chose to sell to the Crown all their remaining claim to lands between the Ohio and Tennessee rivers, the area that is now Kentucky. So even a century after these wars of the Iroquois, although they owned that territory, it was still mostly deserted. Perhaps you've heard of the American saint, the Lily of the Mohawks. Her name was Saint Catharina Tekakwitha. She suffered from smallpox as a young child, which scarred her face and greatly weakened her eyes. When she was 19, she converted to Roman Catholicism. She took a vow of perpetual virginity. Upon her death at the age of 24, just minutes after her death, witnesses say her scars vanished, and she appeared radiant and beautiful. For some time after death, Tekakwitha was considered an honorary yet unofficial patroness of Montreal, Canada, and indigenous peoples of the Americas. 50 years after death, a convent for Native American nuns opened in Mexico. How did it happen that she converted to Catholicism? Well, other Jesuits had followed the martyrs into Mohawk lands, and one of these missionaries was known to Iroquois as Dawn of the Day. He was Father Jacques de Lambeville. He had the honor of baptizing Catharina. Father Lambeville sent her to the Salt Mission in the north, where eventually she passed away in 1680. When word of her passing was spread out through the region, only four words were necessary. The priests, Indians, trappers, and all the settlers simply announced the saint is dead. The Iroquois Confederacy provided another stalwart defender of the faith, the Onondaga chief, Garantier. He was a highly respected warrior. He traveled to Quebec to meet the bishop, Blessed François Laval de Montmorency. The bishop of the large Quebec diocese was a remarkable prelate, called a true father of the Indian nations. Garakonti told the bishop that he desired baptism, and the bishop performed the ceremony. Many other chiefs joined Garakonti in his conversion. The Onondaga chief, who took the Christian name of Daniel, protected the black robes and reopened the Iroquois missions. This was about 1667. This made the baptism of the Lily of the Mohawks possible. Missions were being established elsewhere. In California, in Florida, the Jesuits and Franciscans, aided by Carmelites, Vincentians, Benedictines, Dominicans, Oblates, and secular priests from the Quebec Mission Seminary, opened vast chains of outposts of Catholicism in Indian territories, bringing thousands into the church. Bishops came from Cuba to confirm these converts. Jesuits and Franciscans worked together in the same regions, but differed considerably in their approach to evangelization. The Jesuits labored alone or in small teams, traveling with the tribes on their seasonal treks, even hunting the buffalo herds. They became famous as circuit priests, riding horses across vast wildernesses to visit the faithful. They were held in places of honor among the tribes. The Franciscans, on the other hand, built permanent missions. Led by Junipero Serra, Franciscans established the missions of Alta California. That's the name given to California above the Baja. The first mission was begun in 1769 at San Diego, on the site of the city that has that name now, San Diego. 21 more missions were founded along the El Camino Real, the Royal Road, a chain that extends from San Diego in the south all the way up to Napa Valley. The missions served as the principal centers of evangelization in California. Thousands of Indians were taught trades in these missions and helped to adjust to life in the Spanish society that had suddenly been thrust upon them. The missions safeguarded the Indians against often cruel Spanish landowners who sought to exploit them and turn them into indentured workers. In Florida, the missions were launched almost immediately after Ponce de Leon first entered Florida. Now, that's a lot earlier than the other missions we've been discussing. 1513, only 11 years after Columbus discovered America. Florida and the area around it proved much more difficult to evangelize. For the first half of the 16th century, Spanish expeditions failed to establish a lasting presence, and missionaries traveling with them encountered determinedly hostile native tribes. After a few decades, a more concerted effort was made when the Dominicans assumed direction of the missions. When this failed, the Dominicans were succeeded by the Jesuits. They left Florida also, as the climatic conditions there and the hostility to the Indians offered little prospect of a permanent settlement. The Spanish government decided to make another try. Under Pedro Menendez de Avilés, the first permanent city in Spanish Florida, St. Augustine, was established, 1565. He brought two priests with him, who founded there a parish, the first in what is now the United States. Of course, this was preceded by 6 centuries in Nova Scotia by the Vikings, who established 14 parishes in the first century of the new millennium. The Franciscans made real progress. They created a chain of missions across Florida and then into Georgia. More than 30,000 Indians had been converted by 1634. With that widespread foundation of the Catholic faith, you would think the southeastern United States would have a great Catholic presence today. But this great Catholic beginning was about to be destroyed. We'll talk about that after the break. Setting the record straight, Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin, back with you. And we're brought to you on redboxmedia.com. Especially for you. We're considering today the missions among the Indians by the Catholic Church before the formation of the United States. And I just brought up the 30,000 converts from among the Indians in the southeastern United States and Florida. It was a fine beginning, at a great cost to the missionaries, who worked under very difficult circumstances. But after a number of attempts by the Spanish missions that had failed, now things were succeeding. But then something happened. The missions fell under attack as part of a wider conflict between Spain and England. During Queen Anne's War in the early 1700s, the English troops, colonists with their Indian allies, launched brutal attacks on the Florida missions from their bases in the Carolinas. Over the next years, churches were burned to the ground, friars were tortured and then killed, and Catholic Indians were slaughtered. One of the worst attacks was in 1740. The British colony of Georgia, under the command of General James Oglethorpe, launched a vicious attack, partly motivated by Catholicism, against St. Augustine. Franciscans were slain with a remarkable savagery. A reported 1,400 Catholic Indians were taken to Charleston and sold as slaves. Already suffering decline because of the weakened Spanish government in Florida, the missions went into decline. The British sacked and burned St. Augustine to the ground again in 1763. That same year, Spain lost Florida to England in the Treaty of Paris. There was supposed religious freedom in Florida under the English, but most of the Spanish Catholics left the area. It was a long campaign by the British Crown to eliminate Catholic colonies in the New World. St. Augustine was a particular target. In all, the British destroyed St. Augustine 5 times. When was the first time? In 1586, St. Augustine was sacked and burned by Sir Francis Drake of England under the direction of Queen Elizabeth. 80 years later, 1668, the English, led by Robert Searles, again looted and burned St. Augustine. 1702, English invaders from Carolina laid siege to the Castillo San Marco for 52 days. The English were not successful in destroying the fort, but they did destroy the town as they withdrew. And as we mentioned, in 1740, the British invaders from Georgia and Carolina, under the command of General James Oglethorpe, bombarded St. Augustine for 31 days. Finally, now in 1763, Governor and General James Oglethorpe again led the British troops to sack and destroy the town. The charter of the British colony of Georgia assured religious toleration to all, except for Catholics. St. Augustine is still there. What a resilient city. Now, the British anti-Catholic policies had no impact further west, in Texas, Louisiana, and on the West Coast, where mission functions without too much interference. Franciscans labored in Louisiana and Texas and built the glorious San Antonio shrines, including San Antonio de Valleja. This old mission building is greatly revered in Texas. You know its name now. It's called the Alamo. Let me name some other mission sites. Places named Kaskaskia, Cahokia, and San Xavier de Bac stood as monuments of the Catholic faith in North America. But they were built at a terrible price. More than 120 Catholic missionaries in some 18 states were slain at their posts, but still more missionaries followed in their footsteps. The American Revolutionary War not only ended British rule in the colonies, but eased the restrictions on Catholics in the practice of their religion. There was quite a change in 1803 with the Louisiana Purchase, which inspired a great westward migration. But it was not all voluntary. Part of this westward migration was the Trail of Tears, which was endured by various Indian nations, forcibly removed from their lands, and marched to barren and harsh new sites. One of these Indian nations was the Potawatomi, who were guarded by federal troops on the trail westward. A young, newly ordained priest, Father Benjamin Pettit, accompanied the Potawatomi and marched alongside his Indian flock, provided the sacraments, and consoled the victims of the forced migration. He was horrified at the cruelty and inhumane treatment. When the Potawatomi reached Kansas, their destination, another Catholic priest was waiting, Father Christian Hocken, the Jesuit companion of the famous Father Peter Jean de Smet. Father Hocken had built a mission and had stored vast supplies to welcome the exiles. The young Father Petit was already ill from the long trek, and he bade the Potawatomi farewell and returned to his home parish, where he died soon after. Even today, he remains a cherished figure in the memory of a Potawatomi nation. You may know the Archbishop Charles Chaput of Denver. He's the first Native American archbishop, and Bishop Chaput is of the Potawatomi tribe. The Potawatomi nation was also served at Sugar Creek Mission by the Society of the Sacred Heart. An older nun founded the Indian mission schools. Unable to speak the language of the Potawatomi and not truly conversant in English, she visited the school in 1841. The Indians called her the woman who prays always. The world honors her today as St. Rose Philippine Duquesne. In Montana and the Dakotas, the evangelization continued unbroken, missionaries becoming part of the lives of the Indian nations. One Oblate missionary, Father Albert Lacombe, was caught up in an attack of the Blackfeet by the Cree in a battle in the Rocky Mountain region. A stray bullet grazed his head, and the battle came to an abrupt halt as the Blackfeet shouted to the Cree, "You have wounded your black robe." Incredibly, the medicine men from each of the tribes went to the black robe's aid. As the U.S. population expanded westward in the 19th century, conflicts with the Indians inevitably erupted. The main problem was that the Indians of the plains did not want to live in settled communities, but preferred the life of the hunter roaming vast spaces in search of game. This preference conflicted directly with the westward expansion of the U.S., which filled the formerly open prairies. It's easy to look back, but it seems that surely some compromise could have been made. The Indians could have been given good fertile lands and instruction in farming and other trades, much as the Spanish and French did in the same areas that they colonized. The Indians could then have taken their places as citizens with special customs, just as the European immigrants contributed their special cultures to America. Instead, the official policy of the U.S. government was to drive the Indians ever farther westward, breaking one treaty after another, finally forcing them onto reservations, which contained the worst lands. An heroic Belgian priest pointed to an alternative, but unfortunately he was not heeded. His name is Pierre-Jean de Smet. He arrived in the U.S. from Belgium in 1823. 14 years later, he founded his first Indian mission at Council Bluffs, Iowa. His reputation for respect and love for the Indians spread rapidly among the far western tribes. Representatives of the Flatheads and Nez Perce of the Rocky Mountains came to De Smet, begging him to come to them. In 1840, he crossed the Continental Divide at South Pass, and on Sunday of July 5th, he celebrated the Mass at Green River, Wyoming, where thousands of Indians had come for fur trading. Father De Smet left Green River on July 6th, crossing the 8,000-foot Teton Pass through a snowstorm. He reached the main settlement of the Flathead Indians, who welcomed him joyously. In only 2 months, he baptized 6,000. He established St. Mary's Mission, the first permanent white settlement in what is now Montana. By early spring in 1842, he could report that almost the whole Flathead Nation had been converted to Catholicism. He decided to journey to the Oregon Territory to investigate mission prospects there. His reputation preceded him, and he was met with many requests for Mass and for baptisms. He could see the need for a permanent mission, so he returned to St. Louis for help. It was on one of his two journeys that he discovered gold in a mountain stream. But as badly as he needed money, he refused to mention the discovery to anybody, because he knew that the gold would bring a flood of white settlers, resulting in the extermination of the Indians. 1846, 4 years later, gold was then discovered by someone who told of it, and the great gold rush of European immigrants into the California area started. Father De Smet tried to persuade the government to adopt a constructive policy toward the Indians, advocating the gradual development of agricultural programs, but the government would not listen. When the Indians west of the mountains rebelled, the army begged Father De Smet to make peace, but the Indians rebelled only because the white men had violated their treaties and taken away their land, shooting Indians and burning their homes. Nevertheless, he consented at last to travel among the Indian tribes to explain to them that violence would only worsen the situation. His great efforts did bring peace to the Pacific Northwest. But the Plains Indians fought on. In 1862, the Sioux went on a rampage, and again the government frantically called for Father DeSmet. He went to Fort Berthold in the Dakota Territory to be warmly welcomed by the Indians massed there for protection against the Sioux. On the afternoon of July 8th, the Sioux appeared across the river, steadily increasing in number. Father DeSmet announced he would cross the river. Everyone begged him not to go, thinking it would mean certain death. The priest calmly climbed into a small boat, which he rowed across the river. He was immediately surrounded by the Sioux. For 3 hours, the people at the fort kept vigil. They were sure that their beloved Black Robe had been killed. This is Chuck Coughlin. We'll find out what happened to Father DeSmet after the break.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on breadboxmedia.com, especially for you. Just before the break, we had seen that a group of Indian tribes had collected on one side of the Missouri River. We're facing across the river, where the Sioux were massing for an attack. The Sioux had been on a rampage. Father Pierre-Jean DeSmet had announced they would cross the river, and everyone had begged him not to go. Father DeSmet was going to a certain death. He had gotten in a small boat and calmly rowed over to the other side of the river and disappeared among the crowds of the Sioux. An hour dragged slowly past, then 2 hours, then 3 hours. Everyone was watching from this side of the bank. They were sure their beloved Black Robe had been killed. Then, as the sun began to set, they saw the little boat put out from the opposite shore. Rowing toward them back across the river was Father DeSmet. He had met with no difficulty. The Sioux had come only to visit him, whom they regarded as their friend. No other white man could have crossed the Missouri River that day and survived. Father DeSmet told the government that he would not continue to negotiate with the Indians unless the officials would keep their promises. General Sully, speaking for the government, refused. He had been sent to punish the Sioux, and punish them he would. DeSmet went back to St. Louis. A few years later, he was back among the Indians. He compiled a list of their grievances, which he sent to Washington with the admonition peace could be brought about if honest agents were employed. Finally, he was persuaded to go among the Sioux to bring their leaders to a peace conference. Though ill and weak, he went deep into the wilderness, meeting with four chiefs, Sitting Bull, Four Horns, Black Moon, and No Neck. As a result of his efforts, the Sioux and the Cheyenne did sign a treaty with the government, giving up most of their traditional hunting grounds in return for a guarantee that they would always possess their sacred Black Hills. But gold was discovered in the Black Hills. The government tried first to persuade the Indians to sell the land, but Chief Sitting Bull contemptuously declared that he would not sell the white man so much as a pinch of dust. So the Indian Bureau issued an order that all Indians must report to the nearest Indian agency within a certain time. As it was winter, the order was impossible to obey. Using this failure to report as an excuse, the U.S. Army launched a three-pronged invasion of Indian territory, planning to wipe out any Indians who would not peacefully accept the loss of their lands. This was the Second Sioux War. One of the generals was a flamboyant Civil War veteran by the name of George Armstrong Custer. He sent his greatly outnumbered forces to attack an Indian encampment in broad daylight. It was June 26, 1876. Soon the Indian warriors massed and surrounded Custer and his men. Observers watching from a distance could see only clouds of dust and smoke as the day wore on. When the dust settled, they saw that every single U.S. soldier, all 264 men, were dead,
including Custer.
But that was one battle. Overall, the Indians were vastly outnumbered and not nearly so well equipped as the U.S. forces. In May 1877, Crazy Horse was forced to surrender and was killed a few months later, while Sitting Bull fled to Canada for a time.
There's a famous photograph of him from this time. You can find it on the internet. You will see he's wearing a large crucifix around his neck, the size that a priest might wear.
Of course, Sitting Bull was a Catholic. Elsewhere, the Nez Perce War in the Pacific Northwest ended in the defeat of Chief Joseph and the banishment of the tribe to Oklahoma. The Apache War in New Mexico and Arizona started in 1871 and went on for 15 years. It began with a massacre of over 100 Apaches at Camp Grant, Arizona, and ended with the capture of Geronimo and the assignment of the remnants of the tribes to small reservations in the Southwest. The Ghost Dance War on the Black Hills Reservation came to an end with the massacre of Indians at Wounded Knee after the army had tried to curb the religious rites in the Teton Sioux. Father De Smet did not live to see these last bitter defeats. In 1870, he had attended a government conference on Indian missions and was on his way to the East Coast. It was 1870. Later, he was informed that of the 43 missions authorized for the West, only four of the 43 were to be assigned to Catholics. He wrote about this. In the whole of this affair, the Indians have not been consulted as to the religion they desired to belong to. That year, he died peacefully in his sleep. Throughout the Indian territories, riders carried the sad news from village to village. Their beloved black robe dead. The U.S. government virtually prohibiting other Catholic missionaries from carrying on De Smet's work. The Indians were left with only desert land, broken promises, and silent graves.
And very few Catholic priests. I want to credit the historian Ann Carroll's wonderful high school textbooks for much of this material about Father De Smet. During Father De Smet's missionary labors, he had traveled a remarkable 16,000 miles across America serving Indian nations. Before his death, he visited Archbishop Francis Norbert Blanchett in Oregon, and they discussed the alarming policies of the U.S. government concerning the Catholic missions. Archbishop Blanchett sent a veteran missionary, Father Jean-Baptiste Abraham Broliet, to Baltimore to confer with Archbishop James Roosevelt Bailey. Archbishop Bailey was the nephew of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. He was a convert to Catholicism and a dynamic defender of Catholic rights. He sent Father Boulle to Washington, D.C., where President Ulysses S. Grant's new peace policy for the Indians placed all Indian missions under the control and auspice of Protestant groups. This was one of the many signs of President Grant's anti-Catholicism. The American bishops were alerted to the growing threats and backed the efforts of the Archbishop to establish a reliable agency of defense. They held the first meeting of the Bureau of Catholic Indian Missions, and it was opened with the task of defending Catholic rights in caring for Native American Catholics and the safety of the Catholic missions. This was 1873. Catholic leaders spoke out on behalf of the missions in the U.S. Senate, and a few years later, Grant's peace policy was defeated. Prominent Catholics then volunteered to serve on the Federal Bureau of Indian Missions, including the famed Washington lawyer Charles Joseph Bonaparte and James Cardinal Gibbons of Baltimore. The Catholic Church in America had come of age after centuries of service.
The battles were now in the bureaucratic wildlands of America. The legacy of the missionaries and the Catholic Native Americans provided the model for future generations.
A young Italian sister of charity, Blandina Segale, was just 22 years old in 1872.
She got an assignment from her superior
to journey to Trinidad, Colorado. She was going to the Wild West, to a primitive town of dugouts, Indians, outlaws,
and young children who needed a teacher.
Her adventures in Trinidad and later in Santa Fe and Albuquerque
would make great material for a movie.
There's a lot of stories like this. There was a drunken quarrel between two men. The men drew their guns and one man shot the other. As the wounded man lay dying, a lynch mob gathered outside the jail, ready to hang him. Sister Blandina rushed to the dying man's room and persuaded him to forgive the killer. She then got permission to bring the other man from the jail and walk with him to the room so he could ask pardon and receive forgiveness from the man he had just shot. She stopped the lynching. The man received 10 years for manslaughter and owed his life to Sister Blandina. Another time, an outlaw from Billy the Kid's gang was wounded in the leg. No doctor in Trinidad dared to treat him. Sister Blandina went to his room and cared for him, returned day after day. Then Billy the Kid himself arrived. He was vowing to scalp every one of the four doctors in town for not helping his partner. When he arrived at the shack where his friend lay, he met Sister Blandina and learned of her act of charity. In gratitude, he promised her any favor she asked. She asked that he not take revenge on the doctors. He kept his promise, and ever after had a soft spot in his heart for the little sister of charity. She had not feared an outlaw's wrath. Later on, Billy the Kid spared a party of travelers from the ravages of his gang. When he recognized who was riding with him, it was Sister Blandina. St. Pope John Paul II addressed the issue of Native Americans. He described an authentic approach to the history of the encounter between the Native Americans and the Catholic Church when he addressed a gathering of Indians in Phoenix, Arizona, 1987. He spoke these words: "The early encounter between your traditional cultures and the European way of life was an event of such significance and change that it profoundly influences your collective life even today. That encounter was a harsh and painful reality for your peoples. The cultural oppression, the injustices, the disruption of your life and of your traditional societies must be acknowledged. At the same time, in order to be objective, history must record the deeply positive aspects of your people's encounter with the culture that came from Europe. Among these positive aspects, I wish to recall the work of the many missionaries who strenuously defended the right of the original inhabitants of this land. They established missions throughout the southwestern part of the United States. They worked to improve living conditions and set up educational systems, learning your language in order to do so. Above all, they proclaim the good news of salvation in our Lord Jesus Christ, an essential part of which that all men and women are equally children of God and must be respected and loved as such. This gospel of Jesus Christ is today and will remain forever the greatest pride and possession of your people." For Real Life Radio and Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin.